You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Paul McDevitt. He's talking to me from Berlin. Paul, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Hi.
So, Paul, let's talk about what you're working on now. I mean, you're in Berlin, and maybe I should ask you just a little bit about Berlin. I know you came there from Scotland. What's it like to be working in Berlin, and how do you like it as opposed to other places you've been to, you know, say the UK?
Well, I lived in London for 8 years prior to coming here. I studied there as well, and in a way, I think Berlin's a little bit of a paradise for artists, especially if you can source an income from elsewhere, if you can sell work in galleries, in London or New York or somewhere where there's actually some money, then Berlin's it's still kind of a playground. It's still quite wild here, cheap, and not really constricted by the kind of regulations that one would find in normal Western capital cities in terms of what you can and can't do and what taxes you have to pay for a space. You know, here still people still seem to find room to set up the kind of projects they want to do and live in the part of the city they want to live in without really having too much concern about their financial status. You know, the streets, it's still quite mixed, you know, between rich and poor and in the same area. No, it's a great city. It's terrific.
And in terms of exhibitions, so there's a certain kind of freedom for artists. I mean, I was just talking to another artist today about Berlin and that there's a certain kind of freedom for artists. So when you talk about it being a playground, it's also in terms of exhibitions. Is it fairly easy to mount an exhibition? And are we talking about nonprofit spaces or galleries?
There's a lot of nonprofit spaces here for sure, and there's also a whole sort of slew of commercial galleries. But there's no money here, so no one really makes any money here. It's a great place to show work and to see work, but all the money comes from elsewhere. The galleries here, the commercial galleries survive on international art fairs. And like I said, most artists would get money from elsewhere, and no one's really making any money here. And the kind of day jobs that artists usually have, like technician work in museums and so forth, it's very low here in terms of pay rates. So in that respect, it's not an easy place to be, but no one seems to have a job here, unlike London, where everybody worked all the hours they could, you know?
So that does sound like a playground.
The cafes here are full at 11:30 in the morning, let's put it that way.
But you're also exhibiting around the world, aren't you? Is that currently what's happening with you? Before we get into talking about your work, are you having different exhibits around the world where you're also selling
work?
Yeah.
I work with a couple of galleries internationally. I've worked with Stephen Friedman Gallery in London for a long time, and I have a gallery in Copenhagen, and I recently had a gallery in Berlin until they closed last year. So there's those things going on, and then there's the usual other projects and other kinds of spaces here and there. So
for you, it's possible to live there without having a day job. You're supported by your art for the time being?
Yeah, it's always worked out that way. It's not getting any easier, I have to say, but it was great in the beginning. Berlin was very cheap compared to London, but now things are kind of turning upside down, especially with the whole Brexit thing, and the pound is just getting weaker and weaker. So I don't know what the future's going to hold for international artists here.
So let's talk about what you're working on now. What's happening in the studio? I mean, whether you're preparing for a show or just what happens to be going on at the moment.
Well, I do three main things in the space here, in the studio here. I've got kind of a relatively new live workspace. I've been here for just over a year. So I have the studio here, and I'm currently preparing for an exhibition in a project space in London called Dolph, and that happens in about a month's time, roughly speaking. And that will be one or two paintings and a series of screen prints basically surface patterns, repeat patterns. And it's all based on found painterly gesture, basically things from the street. And then I have a project space that I run from the front of the studio, which is a sort of former butcher's shop, probably like decoratively tiled space, probably around 100 years old, which was a sort of discovery upon moving into this place. The whole walls were covered up with white boards, and it was meant to be one of my studio rooms, but Yeah, upon discovering these kind of decorative tiles in this front room on the street front, I decided to open that as a project space. So that's been going for a little over a year now, showing other artists' work, kind of a combination of sound and visual work. And then I co-run a record.
So I want to talk about what's happening in the back of the studio, or just go on with that. But in the project space, which maybe we'll come back to, this is obviously a kind of a nonprofit venture. You're not a nonprofit, but you're it's an artist-run space. It's a project space, and you're curating other artists just for the sake of doing that, right? It's not about sales or a commercial gallery. It's about
It's kind of the antithesis of that. I mean, I got the feeling that, like, certainly I'm in my mid-40s now, and a lot of people my age are really having a much harder time because the middle ground's really fallen away in some, you know, for a lot of the art world, galleries and artists alike, in that there's always a lot of attention on younger artists or spaces and the much more established, but for anything in between, it certainly gets more difficult now. So I really felt like I wanted to take a bit more control about my everyday life and my schedule and what I do. And I thought I wanted to be in charge of the kind of activities that I wanted to initiate my own activities and to make things happen as and when I saw fit. So that was the real reason for starting a space was for that, to have the sort of freedom to operate on my own timeline and not be fitting into somebody else's.
That's like an important way for you know, a lot of artists who are creating kind of institutions or projects or collaborative spaces, is it kind of puts you in the driver's seat a little bit, gives you a little more control.
It's an issue of control. That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
And so you're about to go on to another project that you're doing.
Well, the third thing is I run a record label. Well, it's a book and record label, but it's predominantly records that we make these days, vinyl records, with another artist called Cornelius Quabeck, who's currently in Glasgow at the moment. He usually lives in Dusseldorf. And we put out 3 or 4 records a year, which are sort of half. One side is audio, one side is a screen print, and the covers are all handmade by us. So it's very much like a DIY project, and that's that's we work with a lot of contemporary experimental musicians. The last release was Mouse on Mars, who you may know, and we worked with a painter, Marcus Erlin, recently, and also Peter Broderick, who's a Portland-based musician.
So let me understand this, because I didn't know about the label. So on one side of the vinyl there's audio, on the other side there's an image.
It's a 10-inch colored vinyl, each one, yeah. And the covers are risograph printed, which we do here in-house. I've got a kind of print workshop underneath the studio in the cellar. And so one side, it's one track, basically, is the idea. It's one long track, sort of 10 to, between 8 and 13 minutes, I would say, around 10 minutes. And the B-side is a screen-printed image. So the idea is it's really one side art, one side music. And it's really like
But just to be clear about the process, because I want to talk about both of those printing processes.
Uh-huh.
So it's clear how you get the audio on one side. The screen-printed image on the other side, is that colored vinyl, the way colors are embedded into vinyl traditionally, or is it actually like silk screen on top of it? So we're talking about a smooth surface.
It's the latter. So the B-side is not pressed, so it's smooth, and it already has the base color of the vinyl, which we differ with each issue, and we use a second color for the image. So it's very basic, and the covers are the same. It's a risograph on colored paper, so it's kind of it's like a two-color process. We spray a bit on there to make 3 colors. It's very basic, but it looks interesting because you don't see it so often. And it's
I love that idea because, you know, I mean, we're talking about making small editions and artist run editions. So you say risograph. I'm not familiar with that term and how you'd have it printed.
I think you might pronounce it risograph in America. It's a Japanese technology from the 90s. Looks like a Xerox or a photocopier, and it was designed for medium run print runs for schools, universities, things like that. And it's a very economical way of printing, you know, in the hundreds. And what it does is it has a flatbed scanner, which does a very high-resolution scan, and it outputs it makes a master template on banana paper and prints through that, a bit like a screen print. It makes this mask, and it prints through that with liquid ink, with a soy-based ink. So the the input's digital, but the output is very much like offset printing. I mean, the ink is wet on the paper, so it's a very rich very interesting way of printing very quickly as well. But it's a curious combination of technologies, and it has a particular feel and look, and it's a pain in the ass to use if you really want to do things properly. But for artists who are happy to, you know, engage with the personality of the machine and all its idiosyncrasies, it's a terrific tool.
And how big are the editions that you create of each of these 10-inch?
We do 300, and we usually give a bunch of those to the artist. And it's an expensive process, especially with the screen printing. And we didn't know when we started this out. I mean, we chose 10-inch vinyl because the risograph wouldn't print big enough for for a 12-inch cover. But we didn't know at the time that 10-inch colored vinyl is the most expensive thing you can produce. I mean, way more than bigger vinyl, smaller vinyl, black vinyl. So we have a very high production cost. But if we sell, you know, they do sell. I mean, people who buy records, you know, still care about the physical objects. And it's a small print run, but it's enough to keep the thing rolling, basically. Unlike artist books, which we also make, which you basically give away. I mean, no one buys those.
That's interesting, but vinyl more. I mean, I also buy vinyl, and I feel the same way. You know, we're looking for new music, new sounds, but also more and more. And perhaps this is something new in vinyl. It is for me. I'm looking at beautiful packaging more, because people seem to be getting more creative with what you can do with vinyl. And I don't know if it has expanded that much, what can actually be done with vinyl. But it seems that your process is a little bit different, and that's exciting to hear that it can sell through stores as opposed to artist editions of books, which it's interesting. It's not as popular, but you're also picking musicians and bands like Mouth on Mars that are fairly well known. Is that part of the reason that they're selling as well?
Yes, for sure. I mean, the great majority of what we put out is bought by Americans on the whole, I would say, even though it ends up very expensive by the time it reaches the States. You know, our releases, they can kind of end up towards the $40 mark end, which is a lot for 10 minutes. Of music, of course. I mean, but we initially thought that there would be an audience for people who cared about the sound and also cared about the idea this was kind of a print. I mean, the covers are handmade by us. We don't sign them or make a big deal of it, but there as much work goes into that as any print we would make, you know, for a gallery. So we thought there'd be a good kind of crossover appeal, but I think we were a little naive in that respect. It does basically boil down to the fact that no one who is into music knows anything about art, and vice versa. There's about 10 people who kind of who have a kind of working knowledge of both fields.
Now that's very interesting. Cool. That's interesting that those two genres don't cross over, because, you know, I noticed that.
I think every musician thinks they're. I mean, everyone would say they're into art, but they'd have a very kind of workmanlike understanding of what painting is, and, you know, they would be familiar with a few household names. And the same would go for most artists. I mean, they'd all be David Bowie fans, but it wouldn't usually go much deeper than that. And they wouldn't be seeking out new music or going to see live concerts beyond the kind of normal big stars that do tours. I mean, that's generalizing, of course, but it's sort of true. There's not a lot of a crossover, and that's something we didn't expect.
So these are going to audiophiles, people who love music, and they're appreciating the visual work, of course, but also not as much as they might if they knew if they were more involved in the art world, which they're not.
I mean, what we have in our favor is that because we come from the art world, we're in the art world, we have quite an easy time exhibiting them. So we've actually done a lot of exhibitions with the label, presenting books and the records, as well as sort of some other ephemera that we've made, posters and editions and so on. So we've actually had several museum and gallery shows just with the label, which is something that a regular record label couldn't do. And that's kind of the one thing we can offer to the musicians. Like a lot of the people we've worked with, Holly Hendon and so on, that Jeffrey Cantu and Ledesma and Gabriel Salomon from Yellow Swans, they're all quite big names in experimental music. And we can't make them any money, but we can, you know, for what it's worth, put their music and their releases and their sort of their art out there into a different context and put it into a kind of into the art world, which most of them seem to be happy with. So, you know, at least there's
That's exciting. And how many editions have come out so far?
We've done 10 so far over the last 3 years, and we've got another three or four. Kind of two are being mastered right now, so they'll be coming out as soon as, you know, as long as it takes to make a record, another 2 or 3 months, and then another two kind of for later on in the year. And the idea is to cross over. Sorry?
No, I was going to say, and people who are living in other countries, United States or other places, can order these by mail as well?
Yeah, we have a distribution here in Berlin, and that goes to Forced Exposure, which is one of the big U.S. distributors. And like I said, like everyone adds a bit of money onto it, so by the time it reaches a record store in the U.S., it can be a little off-puttingly expensive, but they can also order direct from us. I mean, it's not our day job, so we don't spend an awful lot of time promoting the label. We don't do any social media for it or anything like this. I'd rather people, right. We both would rather people just found it, and it was kind of an exciting discovery. We get a fair amount of reviews, and there's always a little tension on the back of that.
That's great. I'm glad we talked about the label. I mean, yeah, go on. Say what else you were going to say.
I was just going to say, but that's our ambitions are quite low for it. You know, we're actually happy to. We really enjoy what we do, and it's a lot of work making all these covers and so on. And we don't want it to be any bigger or any more successful, because it would be a lot less fun. As it is now, it's great, and we really enjoy who we work with, and we do some live events, and also there's a bit of a crossover with Far Vision, the space I have here, and that some of the, you know, one of the musicians will release a record by later this year will do an exhibition with me first in a sound installation in March. So that was the idea, really, for me, was to have the studio, the project space, the label kind of feeding into one another. And that's actually something that's not very popular in Europe. I mean, it's America, from what I can see as an outsider, is much better at kind of appreciating that somebody has more than one vocation, or that there's, you know, you could be a writer but also be whatever, a musician. You could be something else. In Europe, it's quite difficult to do that. I think there's kind of, I don't know why that is.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't realize that. Because that's true. I mean, even what I do, you know, my wife and I are artists, and I also do some writing, and this interview series is kind of a, you know, an artist-run interview series. It's gotten a lot of attention, but it's a nonprofit venture, but it's something that I see other artists doing as well, creating things that are kind of like organizations or are producing editions, not too dissimilar from what you're doing, small books or other things, because I think that's all part of, as I see it, you know, artistic practice, or certainly can be, because it's not just about, in many cases, your own work. It's also about the community that you're involved in, collaborating, curating, and, you know, publishing in many cases like yours.
Absolutely how I feel about it. And for whatever reason it is, this in Europe, I think it's quite common that there'd be a mistrust of the other things you do. You know, they'd be like, okay, he's kind of an artist, but these other things, you know, what can't be doing them very well. They don't really count, or the other way around, you know. I don't know what it is. I mean, there's just, I think America has a much broader idea. I mean, maybe, I guess America's always been rather fond of kind of crossovers too, you know. You've got this sort of Run DMC Aerosmith thing going on where it's always been rather popular. You know, it's always been popular to kind of combine flavors somehow. I don't know, but whatever it is, I mean, that's kind of my vision for what I do, is to kind of do these things concurrently and let things ebb and swell as and when, you know, necessity dictates. When there's more activity in the project space and the studio's quieter, then attention goes, you know, proportionally there, and vice versa. So
I'm going with all those things, and it's happening. What are you working on now in terms of your visual work?
In the visual work, I've been doing an ongoing series of larger drawing works on paper, which are basically charcoal on paper. They're around 2 meters high. I don't know what that is in imperial terms, but a bit bigger than you and I suppose. And
that's 6 feet high. That's about 6 feet, about the height of a person, a tall person.
6 feet is 183 centimeters, I think, if I'm not mistaken. So like kind of 7-8 foot tall, something like that. And they're based. A lot of them were based on found gesture. It was kind of a coming to terms with. I think it was coming to terms with my kind of earlier ambitions to be a sort of abstract painter, and I started thinking a lot recently about how one how one often returns to the kind of things that you were interested in as a teenager somehow, or what, you know, in a way I think artists don't really, they kind of come fully formed already, you know. I think everything that was in your upbringing is already informed what kind of artist you are, and sometimes you kind of fight against that for a few years and try to be something else. But generally when artists succeed in making interesting work, it's when they've kind of come to terms with what was already there and kind of developed that and pushed that. And so these are kind of abstract, they refer to abstract painting, these works, but they're all made graphically, very much with charcoal by hand, sometimes incorporating some elements of printing. They refer very specifically to these to a series of windows of bankrupt businesses and shops. I mean, what happens in the UK, I don't know if it's the same in the US, but often when a shop goes under on the high street, when it goes bust, they will obscure the view into the empty shop by kind of whitewashing the inside of the window, maybe using buttermilk or a cleaning fluid or something. So you have this kind of, and it's very quickly done, and very, obviously it's about filling the space in the quickest, most economical way. So it's kind of done with a rag or a big brush, just slop it on and quickly brush over the inside of the window. So from the outside, you can't see into this empty shop. And my mother recently retired and moved back to Scotland, where I was born and spent the early years of my life. She moved back to the seaside town of Kirkcaldy in Fife, east of Scotland, which was earlier the world linoleum capital in the 50s or so. It used to be quite a rich city, seaside city, and but it's just been devastated by the financial, you know, economic crisis in the UK. And so the high street in that particular town had quite an astonishing number of closed shops and all these painted gestures. And I kind of got really, I started taking photographs of them and recollaging them. It got so bad there, McDonald's moved out, which I'd never heard of before. They just closed up and
wow.
Moved out. So it was
fine. Yeah, you know it's bad when McDonald's moves.
Yeah, no, desperate. So it's an interesting city because it's also where Adam Smith wrote Wealth of Nations. So the kind of the text that defined you know, free market economies and division of labor and all these sort of things was actually, you know, thought about and conceived and written in this town. And but I started photographing these windows and then playing with them on the computer and recollaging them and then making these new kind of abstract compositions, which are very much like painterly forms, but like I said, executed graphically. So yeah, that's basically
They are very painterly. I mean, some of the viewers will see. Can go to your website, but we'll also have images of these on the interview. But that's kind of fascinating because I've seen those images on your website, and now it is a form that we all know of. I mean, you know, abstraction, you know, takes so many forms. But what happens on those windows is also something that I'm familiar with in the U.S. You know, and. That same thing happens here. The windows are obscure, and the gestures with the way they're obscured, of course, have a sort of a rushed quality, and obviously not initially an aesthetic quality. But at the same time, you know, I mean, in yours is the ones that you photographed or have worked over. You know, there's a certain kind of depth to them as well, and it kind of reads on two layers. It's abstract, but when you're talking about how you're drawing these images, it also becomes about financial crisis. I don't know if that's intended or viewers understand that when they see them, but that's a very interesting layer for abstract work to have those two kind of narratives, right? One that's purely visual and formal, and another one that's about the crisis that we're all involved in to some degree.
Yeah, I thought of them on those two levels. I mean, I thought basically they were. I mean, even the fact they're actually made on paper with charcoal is the two cheapest materials. So it was kind of important for me that they were made. I mean, those things cost like 4 or 5 euro to make one. You know, no one ever talks about this because it's kind of an unsexy thing to talk about. But for me, it was important to do this in the most basic way as well. So it's so easy to spend so much money producing work. I thought, no, this should be really something that doesn't cost anything. Of course, to frame them is another matter because they're large. That's expensive and less simple. But yes, I mean, on one level, it's about gesture, and it's about really the purest kind of gesture in that it was an unconscious gesture. It was really about filling a space in the quickest, most economical way possible. So that's one thing. It's hard to do that as an artist. Like you can't fake that in a way. So I kind of thought in a way it was more interesting to use these genuine existing gestures. And on the other side, it is a portrait. it's a portrait of, I suppose, in a way, British identity, or maybe it's a global Western identity, of recent years. This is, I thought of it like a 21st century pop art in a way. Like it has this pop art idea of the window, you know, the display window and the kind of things. But this is like a black and white, predominantly black and white, representation of a shop where there's nothing left to sell, you know. It's kind of,
and in many cases, as you said, and I can see in some of the images, it starts with that as a base. Sometimes it stays that way, so it looks like the window that many of us are familiar with, and obscure, that probably viewers can imagine without seeing it. But then you also work on top of this image, as in some cases as well, right? With letter forms or other elements that you're literally layering on top of it. Is that correct?
Yeah, or sometimes the letter forms go first. So it's really about, I suppose it's just about setting up little roadblocks for myself so that I don't just end up reproducing the kind of initial sketch or collage that I've made. So I kind of make things a little bit more difficult for myself. I sometimes cut out different letter forms. I mean, there's still some interesting old lettering, especially around East Berlin. It's disappearing now, but there's still some kind of nice shop fronts, some old lettering. I photographed those. I cut some of those shapes out of styrofoam, and then just use it as a very simple printing tool, just rollering, painting it, and then pressing it onto the paper or canvas. And that's something that's just done very quickly at the beginning, and it throws everything else into kind of disarray. And it means the attention focuses onto the actual making of the piece rather than paying too much attention to the source material. It sort of changes everything around.
I like that. Paul, before we go, I want to ask you what book you're reading now. Something that I've asked everybody at the end of the interview, but wondering what you're reading, if you wouldn't mind sharing that with me.
Well, I was just in London and Scotland last week, so this evening I was just reading the Luke Toyman's catalogue for the show he curated of James Ensor at the Royal Academy, which I was lucky to catch on the very last day. So I just, that was what I was reading, kind of waiting to speak to you this evening. And I've just started a novel by Sebastian Barry called The Secret Scripture, of which I can't tell you a great deal, but he's an Irish writer, and I just read his previous novel, which was all about a couple of young gay cowboys in the U.S. as the pioneer era and the Civil War, which was an absolutely terrific novel. So I've got high hopes for this one too.
Paul, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure talking about your work, your project space, and also the collaborative label.
Yeah, likewise. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.